Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another Office Hours. I have a couple of guests here. First of all, there is one of the all-time Super Chat greats, Brulaham. How are you doing, Brulaham?
Very good, you. Thank you for having me on.
And also Nomad, whose last appearance was probably on Unpopular Opinions. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. This is my first stream anywhere this calendar year. So my last appearance was the final UO. So there you go. So it's great to be on.
I have just come directly from making a video where I talk about how I think MAGA has jumped the shark this past week. It's called Why MAGA is Losing Support Fast. And that is going to come out tomorrow morning. I expect there to be fireworks in the comments there. But it is also one of the reasons why we're discussing the US dollar system, the global US dollar system. And why, let's just say, why it may not be so easy for Mr. Trump to unwind what has been built up since 1971. I think that's fair framing for what we're about to discuss here, that it's, you know, he may have all these ideas about how he's going to like bring back manufacturing and how he's going to unwind this thing. But maybe the system is at this point so complex that there's no, I mean, the analogy a lot of people have made is to Perestroika and Gorbachev. You know, the USSR had built, had become this big thing whereby it couldn't actually be reformed without collapsing the whole thing, right? And our discussion here really is about why this may not be as easy as it looks, the you know, the winding back of this system. Is that a fair framing, Brulaham?
Yes. It's important to mention first that essentially the U.S. presidents and the like American establishment gets all of their input about economic activity and what to do from either Wall Street or the central bank, the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve and other central banks worldwide employ a majority of economists. So their messaging is very much essentially PR for its own work. And they don't have nearly the effect that they are selling. So I think this partly explains the massive discrepancy between the actions of someone like Trump right now and potentially like his actions if he had a better understanding of the system.
Dan Cooper in the chat saying AA understanding the euro dollar system challenge impossible, immediately banned. I mean, as if I couldn't understand something like this. You know, I've only got my foundations of economics. I've got plenty of videos on the channel where I've talked about the US debt system. Including one called How US Debt Is Its Superpower. The notion that I couldn't get my head around this is frankly ridiculous. So you, Dan Cooper, sir, are banned. Just before we get going, if you want to buy Foundations of Economics or any of the other great courses, I have a sale on at the moment, which will go up until the end of Easter. It's promo code MANDY, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I was told by a lot of people that they tried promo code MANDY and it didn't work. In fairness to those people, promo code MANDY ran out of coupons. And that's why I have since added more. So it should work now if that was you. So I'll play the promo code. And then these two, Nomad and Brulaham, are going to put on a bit of a masterclass on how this system works.
Country in which I have spent so much of my adult life and admire so much.
Promo code MANDY. 25% off all courses. come on down. Academic Agency. Every single course, 25% off. Promo code Mandy.
Country in which I have spent so much of my adult life and admired.
Someone in the chat wrote, Foundations of Chialdini. You joke, but if you take Foundations of Rhetoric, there is a whole section on Chialdini in there, because persuasion is a huge part of the art of rhetoric, of course. And it's not that people have stopped doing rhetoric. It's just become advertising and marketing, essentially. They kind of keep those dark arts to themselves. But yeah, there's all sorts of social proof and liking and all of these different things, you know, appeal to authority. And you can see it. All you have to do is watch Douglas Murray versus Dave Smith, and you'll see every aspect of Foundations of Rhetoric on full display. Anyway, Brulaham, have you even been to the US dollar system? How can you even talk about it?
I'm not even American. How dare I?
All right. So what is the global US dollar system?
So I think what I'll do is I'll first upfront mention a few people that are discussing this topic in more technical details, just in case I forget later down the road. So these are people that produce content online on this topic. Some of them are experts in their field. And if they don't discuss the system directly, they integrate its notions into their like conversations and theories and things like this. So there's Jeffrey Snyder, Snider, Lynn Alden, Alden, Brent Johnson, which made the dollar milkshake theory, Luke Roman, Gromen. And then there's a really important guy that's a specialist on the central banks called Richard Werner. He's a German economist that worked in Japan in the 90s, and he came up with the quantitative easing. He's the guy that coined the term in 95. Also importantly, in 2014, he published the first empirical proof that banks create money when they grant loans. That's actually a key insight. And then I know you like Super Imperialism by Michael Edson, and some of his insights are touching the global dollar system, but it's kind of like he's walking in the fog. There's things that he's attributing to it that are a bit different. And then all the research by IMF economists and Bank for International Settlements economists. And I believe Nomad has written about the dollar on his Substack. So now that I've said this, I think so. The name of the system is actually the Euro dollar system. It just confuses people a lot because they think Euro, so you mean the Euro, like the currency, and then the dollar, and now they're all confused. The reason it's named the Euro dollar system is only because it was a European US dollars. So it was dollars that were stored in European banks. And eventually it spread throughout the world in some key banking and financial institutions in Asia and pretty much in all, like globally. So I'm calling it the global dollar system just because it makes it more obvious that it's just US dollars globally. Specifically, it's offshore dollars, so dollars that are not under the purview of the Federal Reserve. So it's a really, really complex system. So it's a little bit difficult to explain it without having some information that are given beforehand. So what I'll do is I'll quickly explain what's the purpose of money, why has money come about? Because it's foundational to understanding of the economy and the monetary system worldwide. So essentially, money is just a proxy for trust in a trustless environment. So historically, before we had things that represented money or equivalents, you had other types of exchanges, but typically they were done on very small scales, which meant that people knew people they could trust or not trust. So people would make promises to others to deliver maybe grain in a few months when the harvest happens in exchange for a cow right now or poultry, something like this. or the king in the realm, the leader of a clan, would tell another clan or another king that they're going to exchange a bit later some amount of their goods for some other item or some other key resource that they needed. So this is where money comes from. Essentially, it's the as soon as you make a promise and you defer the completion of the activity, that time difference is essentially what credit is. And it essentially requires trust. And this is what creates money. So the time between the completion of a transaction and the initiation of a transaction is essentially what money is. It's taken many forms over time as societies and civilizations have grown. So what happens is as your society grows, it's very difficult to keep track of who to trust, who not to trust. So people came about with proxies for that trust by essentially doing transfers of goods like cloth or like shells or whatever, but also coinage. And essentially, the better the type of currency, well, not currency, but money you could get your hands on, the higher the trust you could provide to people. So like between kingdom, enemies, friends, etc., which is when you had the advent of gold. So I'll give you a space to chime in.
Yeah, I think it's probably worth, because I have a I have a video which still gets commentary almost every single day. It's called it's about MMT, modern monetary theory.
Yeah,
it's basically called something like Modern Monetary Theory Debunked or Against It, and I basically give a version of that origin of money story that you just spun. And I would say the most common complaint that I get on that video is that actually money didn't come about that way that you just described. It came about basically because of debt, because of IOUs, and because of basically there needs to be a government to sit underneath debt guarantees, and so the history of money is a history of debt and the history of currency, right, i.e. government currency, comes about almost solely because of the debt market. Do you have a rebuttal to that, or a counter, or do you accept that argument?
No, that's so actually, very true.
Sorry, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say a couple of things. No, that's absolutely true, AA. There's a very good book on this by an author called David Graeber, and it's just called Debt. That's what it's called. Yeah. And like you, he argues, the history of money, especially central bank-issued currency, is indeed the history of debt. And the second point is just on modern monetary theory. I remember that video very well, and I think you've been proven right in the post-COVID global economic collapse, really, haven't you? Because that's exactly what the Biden response was. Obviously, the QE, quantitative easing, and the money printing. And I think you've said a couple of times, haven't you, the reason why we're in this predicament at the moment is not because of Russia invading Ukraine or anything like that. It's because of all these periods of, excess liquidity, funny money being pumped into the system, mainly led by the Federal Reserve.
Because it's reached the M0 money supply is my explanation. Because the MMTers were like, look, we did quantitative easing and there wasn't hyperinflation, libertarians owned.
So all of this can be explained by their either misunderstanding of the euro dollar system, the global dollar system, or general misunderstanding of money. So the description you made of debt being the backbone of like monetary systems is completely true, but it directly corresponds to the description I just made about trust. So essentially, economic activity was very limited in scope historically before state-backed currencies. specifically because trust was a major requirement for any type of trade. Like, if you don't have a means to guarantee value, let's say like a gold coin, and you're promising to someone that you're going to deliver like half of your grain in 4 months for some like poultry right now, the person needs to trust you, because otherwise they might like die of starvation, you know? So essentially, when you're doing that extension, that's debt, right? So even like interpersonal trusted transactions are debt-based. The difference is that people don't necessarily keep a ledger of like those type of transactions beyond just remembering, because the liquidity of those transactions is very small, because you need to actually know the individuals or the people in your communities to do those deals, right? And when you're extending that credit, that debt, this is the creation of money. Technically, that's like a materialless money, right? So people don't count those type of interactions as money, but your monetary base evolved from this status. And people think that when they started doing coinage and like doing silver and gold and things like this, that meant that they were doing no extension of credit. They were just doing pure play exchange of gold for goods and things like this. And it was just one-to-one all the time. This is just fundamentally false. And like Nomad said, there's some excellent books on this topic. But essentially, like a king that had control of the coinage, for example, or like an emperor or whatnot, they still extended credit to people, and people trusted that they had the reserves to meet their obligations. This is also credit. And essentially, you're trusting some superstructure to guarantee those transactions. Obviously, when you get into like economic issues, then that breaks. Like, you can have a sovereign debt crisis, things like this, which means that even at the top level, there's a like trust that's broken, which causes like crash and deflationary impacts on the monetary market. But this is essentially what money is, right? So the reason I'm going through these this level of detail up front is because it's key to understand how the global dollar system came to be. And also it's key to understand money, right? Like libertarians are always like, oh, let's go back to gold reserve, like gold-backed currencies, things like this. Even in systems with gold, you're limiting the liquidity of your system because you're like requiring a material thing to be exchanged at a certain point. But there's still like IOUs that are extended for gold that you don't own. Like, people don't carry actual gold around to pay for things, like in the 1800s and 1900s. And essentially, like, without going into too much details about gold and whatnot and that whole conversation, then we can go into the conversation of what is the global dollar system. So so every time I say global dollar system, that means euro dollar system. It's the same thing. It's just easier to not get confused without the word euro. So the global dollar system, it's the biggest market worldwide. Like, it's the biggest amount of money represented as US dollars is in the euro, like the global dollar system. And that system is typically understood as US dollars that are offshore from US dollars in the US in America. So it's US dollars that are not under the purview of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury.
Yeah, that's right. To sort of come in on that, Rulam, yep. That's right. Euro dollars is an informal name given to US dollars that build up outside and beyond the reach and the purview of the Federal Reserve and the US Treasury. This started during the Bretton Woods era, when that's precisely what happened. A parallel market for dollars started accumulating in first European central banks, also Japan as well, actually. And then obviously that led into the sort of commercial banks and whatnot. And that's how the euro dollar markets became sort of originated. And what happened was there was this kind of this parallel system of banking and finance, which nobody predicted, nobody foresaw, predicted at the time of the Bretton Woods Accords. And what happened?
Sorry to get kind of technical and nerdy here, but it's, I think it's important for me to understand as well as everybody else. What do you say outside of the purview of the Fed? As I understand things, U.S. Treasury bonds have to be issued by the U.S. Treasury, right?
Yes.
So when you say this market exists outside of their purview, they do actually have a control in issuing those bonds in the first place, right?
Yes, AA, but crucially, I am talking about the Bretton Woods era. So this is before Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard and all of us off the gold standard, and before the Treasury market was really, really expanded, if you get what I mean. I'm basically talking from, you know, from Bretton Woods up to 71. Then, I mean, in largely in response to a lot of factors putting downward pressure on the dollar, including the euro dollar market, then came, you know, the end of the gold standard, the oil for dollars arrangement with OPEC, quickly following on the heels of the expanded market for U.S. Treasury bonds, which is the mid-70s. Is that right, Brulim? Is that what you...
So I'll add a few more details, which I think AA is going to appreciate. So the system originates back in the World War II era, especially like post-World War II, directly after. And its growth was spurred by the Marshall Plan and the U.S. consumer market exports to Europe. This is why initially it was called the Eurodollar system. So essentially, what happened, and then you have like different historical narratives because it's a bit opaque. It's like considered shadow banking. So there's no like official reporting and public reports made to really give like a good overview of the system. But essentially, the Marshall Plan and the like consumer market that we're exporting to Europe to rebuild Europe, what happened is there was not enough. Back then, we were on a gold standard, right? So there was not enough movement of currency and they needed more liquidity. And also, U.S. banking sector couldn't just make decisions about loans to be given in Europe to rebuild Europe. They didn't have the local knowledge, right? So the implication is that the American government came into agreements post their Bretton Woods Accords that Canada, the Canadian banking sector, the UK banking sector, and some key European players would be able to do loan issuance in US dollar denominated, essentially like denominating the loans in US dollars, okay, to rebuild Europe. And they also, all those countries during the war and after the war, they were sending their gold reserves to the US to protect them from the German. So the US essentially aggregated the gold from Europe. And when they were going to rebuild America, instead of sending back the gold or some kind of agreement like this, they said, we'll keep this safe and you owe us major debt. So we'll essentially do like goods export to you guys and enable you to rebuild your countries by issuing loans, but issue them in US dollars. And because we have your gold, we're going to do like the conversion ratio and like trust us essentially, right? And this goes back to the trust component. So at that point in the world, the key player that was trusted was the Americans. And so the US dollar had some level of dominance after the destruction of Europe. Prior to this, you had the British pound dominance in the world for reserve. It's really that this interconnection of banks between Canada, Britain, and European nations that caused this offshore dollar market to begin to exist. So the key thing to understand is that, and this is what this system started to do. So they weren't able to print actual US dollars, right? So when we're saying global dollar system, it doesn't mean paper dollars. If we go back to what I explained at the beginning of the show, any debt issuance, any credit, whether it be between two farmers or like on a larger scale, that's money, essentially. It's like a trust currency. So when a bank creates a loan, that loan, let's say it's US dollar denominated, creates that money, right? So they don't actually print the money and give it to a farmer. They just enter an entry into a ledger, and then they back the collateral for that loan is the risk assessed investment into productive endeavors, like a business or something like this. So essentially, that's a creation of money. And this is what Richard Werner proved in 2014. This is how banks work. As a matter of fact, they do a risk management analysis internally within the bank, but they don't do a query or a lookup on their like reserves or reserve ratios, or if they have the capability to actually loan dollars. They just issue a loan. That loan creates the money. This is where money creation happens. And maybe getting a bit too ahead of myself, but this is why like all the QE and QT and stuff like this doesn't actually impact the total amount of dollars worldwide. Anyways, that's a maybe for a bit down the line. But it's important to say that some key details is when they started that process of creating those interbank like pipes, let's say. This initially grew heavily under the Marshall Plan all the way to the 70s, but it's really in 71 that it started to grow enormously when the US did the whole like petrodollar. So when they enforced purchase of oil with US dollars only, because then it meant that everybody, every nation on earth, if they wanted to purchase oil, needed to have some amount of US reserve to be able to do those transactions. So that grew the size of the system a lot. So can I
just ask a question, Boulham? Yeah. When the United States government said, right, now anybody in the entire world wants to buy oil has to do it in dollars.
Yeah.
Didn't that lose, like, why didn't that action lose, quote unquote, trust with people? Because, I mean, go on.
So essentially the view from the Second World War on was that most of the historical power players in the world were essentially destroyed. And there was a sense that for a lot of the world, the communist regime was like in opposition to the free world, right? So all of those nations that were rebuilding and making major investments, they were trusting into the US in part because they sent like most of their gold to them. And also because they were like a friend that saved them from the German, you know, enemies and whatnot. So they built trust. And they also were the like reserve holder of gold at that point. And during that period, there was a like the baby boom, and there was like massive growth of economies in the West. And so it's like a spinning wheel, like it's self-reinforcing. The more you grow and the more there's positive economic development, the more people just implicitly trust the system and assume that everything's fine. And those are private players in the West that are essentially doing like internal risk assessments so they don't blow up the banking institutions and the financial institutions. And as long as that works and that they trust each other in the network, they can grow their balance sheet. And over time, there was a few different crises that increased regulatory compliance, but those are done at the country level. And essentially, in the US, you started to see, which ties into the Triffin's dilemma, but you started to see like internal regulation around financial issues and monetary issues. And so the more you create regulation internally in the US, the more players in the financial system will try to create, like generate their loans and their dollars outside of the US system, because then those regulations and rules don't apply to them. And that includes a major banking sector of the US itself, that created like other corporations that are outside the purview of the US. And it's a little bit confusing at this point nowadays, because some of these entities are actually onshore in the US. They just can't do business with American like civilians, like American passport holders, but they can still do transactions outside of the purview of the American regulation with offshore dollars. And that ties into like the global finance centers in London and Canada and Japan and Singapore and China, ties into China, et cetera. And I don't know how deep to go into details into this because we don't have so much time, but essentially when they made an agreement to only trade, like sell petrol for US dollars, it wasn't because the Saudis were like giving the game away to the US. It was because it was already the case that outside of the US, the US dollar already had dominance. So in the private chat, I sent a Twitter called Global Share of Reserve Currencies, a link. I don't know if you can open it and show it. It's a quick GIF that shows like over the years, the estimate of reserve currency shares. And I think it's going to give like a good image, like a good overview for people of like the evolution. So you see the British pound was the key one in the early, before the war. And then you see post-war, the US dollar started to dominate, but then the British pound came back. And then when you get a Second World War, the British pound gets completely like dominated and disappears with its influence. And the US, and this is like those years, this is when you're seeing the US gaining dominance. And then you'll see if the video continues in the 60s, and then it's already at 75-80% of global reserves before the petrodollar, right? And this is when they struck the deals with the petrodollar. And then it moves around over time, but the US remains dominant, the majority of the global reserves. And those are, and then as the market becomes more complex, those values don't accurately represent actual like usage of USD. Essentially nowadays, the what's considered like base monetary dollars or whatever is not actually the entire value of the like money and equivalents. So, one sec, I have so maybe Nomad wants to say something now. Just I'll look up the data I have.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just sort of coming on that. I mean, I've done a lot of work on the what's called the world reserve currency position of the US dollar, and I believe it's about 58-59% of global currency reserves in central banks are in dollars. The US dollar is used in about 90% of all foreign exchange transactions worldwide. So that means that the US dollar makes up one half of all Forex transactions globally. Oh. And some people even say up to 90% of world trade just takes place in dollars, because the system we have is basically built around the US dollar. And that's, you know, that's a system that we've had really since the Bretton Woods agreement. Now, there's obviously been certain changes. We talked about the euro dollar market coming off the gold standard, the petrodollar arrangement, and so on and so forth. You could also add many things to that. You know, there's the expanded market for US treasuries. About 900 billion daily is traded in US treasury bonds. I think only oil is a more liquid market, if you measure it by daily transactions, than US treasuries. And maybe we'll get into this a bit later, but what often happens, and I'm sure you gents have sort of seen this before, is that whenever there's a global crisis, whether it's a regional crisis, a global crisis, or there's uncertainty in the world, what happens is investors turn to US treasuries, because historically speaking, US treasury bonds are the most liquid tradable asset around, arguably the most liquid asset in, you know, recorded history. So what happens is money pours out of everywhere into US treasury bonds. That raises the value of the dollar. Although I don't want to get onto the value of the US dollar, we'll probably touch on that later. What that definitely does do is that reinforces the cycle of the global dollar system, or the empire of dollars, that reinforces the world reserve currency position of the US dollar. It's kind of like a vicious feedback loop. A lot of people, I remember in the wake of the 2008 crisis, the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, which is China's central bank, they said, you know, it's kind of quite ironic, you know, the 2008 crisis originated on American soil, and the net effect, the result of it, is it, you know, pushes up the value of the dollar, because, you know, investors from everywhere, they look for that safe haven. They go to US treasury bonds. But the system is just, I mean, yeah, I've been covering, I've been writing about this, I think I'm into my third year now. So, you know, I've recently touched on another artery of the, you know, the global dollar system, which I'm sure a lot of people in the chat have heard of, you know, the shadow banking system, or financialization, which is a whole nother area. Adolf Brulem has referenced this a couple of times, but I mean, global banking assets, $170 trillion, that's more than actual goods and services, global banking assets. Again, what do we find? The majority of that is denominated in US dollars. Now, there's a bit, you know, I don't want to generalize. There are lots of holdings in euros. There's a, you know, bits and pieces here and there. British pounds are still seen as a relatively safe and secure investment. The last few years have really tested that assumption, but it still is. Swiss francs, a little bit in Japanese yen, but really the dollar is king. There's no way, any way you choose to look at the global monetary system, nobody can deny the fact that it, you know, it runs on dollars. So, and here we are today.
So just to add to this, in the 1970s, the estimation was that the market size of the euro dollar system was 0.4 trillion. That was like significant offshore accounts that were established. In 1985, it was about 1.7 trillion, estimated by JP Morgan. In 97, it was roughly 90% of international loans. So that was complete dominance of the global lending. In the early 2000s, there was an effort done by a research paper to like really go over the entirety of the size of the euro dollar system. And back then it was between like 10 and 15 trillion, if I remember correctly. And the US debt levels were like quite a bit below this at that point. I think it was like half of it roughly. And there was some market size estimation in 2016 that was around 13.8 trillion. Okay. So those, and the size of the US dollars, like the dollars inside the US system, was much more than this, below 10 trillion, if I remember correctly. The key thing to understand about this is that those are all considered like near money and like essentially dollars. It's kind of technical to go into, but this doesn't account for assets on top of this that are essentially leveraged on top of the dollars. So,
yes.
When you saw that percentage of transactions done with the dollar and it was at 59%, this does not count derivatives. And derivative markets are hundreds of trillions of dollars in size. And those are all denominated in US dollar. And maybe not all, but like over 90%. And I'm being conservative. So just a quick point I want to make before I forget. So just to give an application of like what this means for today, okay? So people have trust in the US for decades. Economies worldwide of the Western nations have grown tremendously. The Chinese economy, when they entered the international market and started to export goods, they had essentially no trust with other nations. So the way they build trust is they hold US treasuries and they generate US denominated assets, like debt, and they use this as collateral for trading relationships with other nations. And because their economy was growing so much, they needed a ton of US dollar, not like physical notes, but like near money, like things that are as close as possible as pristine collateral. And so this is partly the explanation for why they've acquired so much American debt. It's because this is what they use to collateralize trade and deals. And this happens like across the world. So whenever there's a, so it used to be that there was like true growth via investment into productive capital to build businesses and make things. But there's also been a stream of financialization. And it's key to understand that banks, when they issue loans, create money out of thin air. This is the money creation. Like, this is how money is created, is by private banking institutions creating loans. And what they've been doing is they've been creating those loans. And since 2008, the global dollar system has been seeing major issues in the background. They haven't had a recovery because there's major issues in liquidity flows in the system. And there's major issues of risk and lack of trust between players of the system and also between nations. So since that crisis in 2007-2008, we've seen a reduction of trust in the American as the global dominant hegemon, which leads directly to other nations and other entities looking at alternatives and trying to build resilience. And one way of doing this is to invest less into productive capacity, like creating new businesses and stuff like this, and more into financialization and playing in derivative markets and trying to do like swaps on interest rates and like playing with the repo markets and like doing like buying US treasuries and just holding that as pristine collateral. And they're trying to position themselves with as little risk as possible so that if they see a crash or if they see a strengthening of the dollar via like the military theory, they are still liquid and they're able to essentially have a be well positioned. That's like a very simple explanation of the dynamics of the system, but this explains quite a bit like what has been happening. And I mean, it's an extremely complex system. Just I forgot to ask you to bring it up, AA. The first link of Twitter, I sent the map of dollar system. Maybe just open this link to show it's an image of like components of the dollar system worldwide. Just so people understand like that, why we can't go into very specific details of like how it works. It's incredibly complex.
So, yeah, that's an understatement.
So you can see like the offshore players, you can see international regulators, supranational regulators, domestic regulators in the US. You can see payment and settlement, which includes crypto, like stable current stable coins. You have primary dealers, you have like a ton of complexity, and then you have the Federal Reserve, and it's a small component. And one of the things I want to maybe explain before I forget and I have to go is it's really, really important for people to understand that the banks are generating, like they're leading money creation via credit. This is actually money creation. And if they do it recklessly, technically that could be inflationary, but it's a relatively sound system because one player can do this and then default or go under, and then other players are gonna like behave with their internal risk management. This is like the theory or the way it's been working so far. And the Federal Reserve doesn't create money. It doesn't print money. It's just, this is why when you were talking about the modern monetary theory, modern portfolio, anyways, MMT guys, and also like libertarians and stuff talking about inflation all the time in the US. What they're missing is when the Fed does QE or when the Fed is, when the Fed does QE, what they're doing is essentially doing open market operations to buy back treasuries. And they're what they're giving to the primary dealers, those like primary banks that have a relationship with them, they're giving them bank reserves. But those reserves are only tokens that are useful within the federal reserve network and between those banks, and they essentially don't, they never get to people at the end, right? And what they're attempting to do, they're attempting to buy treasuries, to pull treasuries out of the market and other assets like mortgage-backed securities, and to give them bank reserves internally in the system, which would then mean that they have like fewer treasuries, and then they would be creating more loans to create more money to increase liquidity and economic activity. That's what they're trying to do when they're doing this. So they're trying to indirectly create money, but they don't have any power to do this. And typically when they're resorting to QE, it's because there's fundamental liquidity issues in the global financial system. So those banks are already not creating loans because of their internal risk management like policy within the banking system. So those banks, when they're creating loans, they never look at their bank reserves at the Fed to decide whether they're going to issue a loan or not. They like interest rates at the Fed, like the Fed funds rate, is like a tiny component of their decision to make or not make loans. And essentially, it's that's just not money creation. A component that can cause inflation, and we've seen it cause inflation during the 2020s, is the Treasury in the U.S. doing fiscal policies that essentially do create U.S. dollars, and then they do something with it, right? This is like the Treasury's role. When they're doing, when they're using those dollars to do productive, like increased productive capacity, like investments into banks and things like this, this is neutral, like it doesn't cause inflation or it grows the economy. But when they're doing consumption, like giving money to people directly, like $500 directly to, you know, buy flights to Miami and party and buy food and things like this, this causes inflation. So like the Fed's operations essentially doesn't really have a big effect on the overall market because the majority of the flows are outside their purview. And the Treasury is able to do fiscal policy that causes inflation, but it's usually like a relatively transitory. It's just essentially more dollars running after fewer goods within the US, right? Okay, so another thing I wanted to say, because I see my time is running relatively short, is that if you're speaking about tariffs, a key insight that people are missing is that the offshore dollars, this debt generated outside of the US, it's all essentially leveraged debt because they can't actually print US dollars. They're not the US Treasury. They create assets. They assign a debt value to it that's denominated in US. So they need US to pay back this debt or collateralize via US near money, like US Treasuries, things like this. This debt, while the economy is growing, is fine because you just have an increase of loan, more and more loans, more and more liquidity. And this credit is kept on a ledger between those banks, and they're all doing like trades throughout the system, right? The issue is when you're seeing economic issues in the system, especially in the monetary system, where liquidity is slowing down and people, all those banks and all those financial institutions are starting to reduce the level of activity they do because they're worried that something might break in the system. What they do is they do fewer loans, etc. So what you see is you have all of those derivatives, all of those financialized assets that are all layered on top of a very small actual US dollar monetary base. So the US, I think if you look at M1 stats, I forget the current statistics, but let's say it's like below 10 trillions. And then you have the M2, which is leverage on top of M1. So it's essentially four times, I believe, the M1, M2. And then the euro dollar system, like the offshore dollars, that's leverage on top of that monetary mass. And that's hundreds of trillions if you count derivatives.
Now, Brulaham, just to try to bring this, make this a bit more concrete.
Yeah.
I read that there are $2.4 trillion in circulation, of which half are outside the US. What you're saying is, on paper, the actual total dollar amount is many times more, because those dollars, yes, don't actually exist. They are IOUs.
Yeah, all of them are IOUs. They're all debt-based collateralized assets. So essentially, when the economy is growing...
Sorry, can I ask a question, though?
Yeah,
let's just stick with the with the dollars that do exist in circulation, right? So 2.4 trillion in circulation, of which half are outside the US. So about $1.2 trillion sit outside of the actual United States. Are those dollars an expression of American power? Or is the fact that they are sitting outside of the US means that it actually has nothing to do with US power, in your estimation?
So I assume that money you're referring to is like actual dollars?
Actual dollars, yeah.
Yeah, so this this has a quite small impact on the overall system, because those are not the main conduits of liquidity. Like, actual dollars are not used as much at this point. It's mostly digital ledgers. So the US in its M1, they have other types of assets that they considered also like base money. So those would be what you consider the like the total number of actual dollars in the system, right? They're not just paper dollars. They're also other types of assets. So M1 is a tiny fraction of the overall global US dollar debt. And essentially, when you have downturns and you have like economic issues worldwide, or when you start to reduce the level of trade between nations, you're reducing the capacity for these institutions to generate new loans in US dollar and essentially like collateralize new things to maintain their credit.
I guess my question is, if you're a Trump supporter sitting there in Alabama, right, excited about Liberation Day, so what? Why do you care about this? Like, how does it affect you?
These
trillions of dollars sitting outside the US. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is the issue, is that like even like people that work in this, like in the financial sector, aren't even aware about this because it doesn't impact their life directly, as far as they can tell. I'll give you an example that has to do with tariffs to give you an idea of like how it impacts the real world. So the US is exporting dollars, which you were stating to people online, where they're like sending US dollars, which costs them nothing, via treasuries or whatever, and buying goods, which they get for nothing, right? The reason why other nations are willing to get those dollars and send goods to the US for nothing is because all these dollars, like quote unquote real dollars that are coming into their economies, is deleveraging their debt, the debt they have. So if they have $100 trillion worth of debt that's denominated in US dollars, right? And they receive inflows of X billions per year in actual dollars coming from like American customers, this increases the amount of real dollars they have under their leverage collateralized US debt. So this is why I'm saying that when the US does this money export to the rest of the world, like to China and other players, they're actually deleveraging the US dollar system overseas. So when these guys are adding tariffs, for example, they're essentially trying to remove this offshoring of dollar, which means that it's causing major stress in those other economies, because now they have no way of acquiring real dollars. Well, not no ways. They have other ways, but it's like it removes a major component of the reception of real dollars from the US, because the US are the only ones that are able to like actually print quote unquote real dollars. But the entire system works on a ledger of promises, and they basically are trusting each other. So, I mean, it's very difficult. It's a very complex system. It's very difficult to get your head around it, and I'm sure I'm not explaining the best way possible, but once you get your head around this system, then it makes a lot of sense, the dynamics of things that are going on right now. So I think, for example, the US and their actions via like Russia and their dominance and their actions via China and the Middle East and different players around the world, they've been causing damage to their reputation and their trust internationally since 2007 to 2008, especially. So all of these other countries have been looking at other asset classes, other types of investments, or other systems that could replace eventually the US dollar. And the more they're damaging their image internationally, the more they're pushing those other nations to try to find other avenues, like those commercial partners and banks, etc. So what you're seeing is those guys are those guys are essentially they're damaging the impact and the dominance of the US dollar internationally, which is partly why all of these countries are now buying gold en masse, and some of them are investing in crypto and stablecoins and Bitcoin, but also in other baskets of currencies. Like you hear about the BRICS settlement system, the digital yuan, all of these other options. They're trying to move away from the US dollar, but they still have long-running debt that's still denominated in US dollar. So they can't completely do away with it. But if the system does completely collapse, then at least they have some other means of transacting. So even if they like default on their debt and they start anew, then they're building trust between other nations, other corporate entities, which is why partly you see those tariffs application. I think what Trump and his administration are really missing, even though some tariffs are probably positive for the manufacturing base of the US, is they don't realize that since 2008, they've been damaging enormously the US credibility internationally. And so what you see is like Trump thinking they're still like in the 80s with global dollar dominance, but actually they're now in a very precarious position. And they're applying tariffs, which are damaging all of the financial institutions in the US, because they're also playing in those games of foreign dollars. And internationally, all of these other nations that also need dollar, but they're like trusting the US less and less. So you've seen the bonds, the treasury market, like yields increasing and the value of bonds decreasing when they were expecting them to do a risk off movement of acquiring more treasuries. But I think what they didn't take into account is that those offshore dollars are doing massive basis trades and like interest rate swaps and repo market. Like those are massive markets, like $1 trillion+ market each. And they were unwinding those derivative trades. And what that means is that those entities were holding US treasuries, and they were forced to dump their treasuries because they couldn't find liquidity elsewhere in the system to be able to get dollars to not get margin called. Anyways, it's really complex, that side of things, but essentially you had enormous pressure in the like currency swaps and the basis trades on the like on the US treasuries, which I don't think they expected for this to like break.
One of the things I remember the Biden administration doing at the height of Ukraine madness was leaning on and bullying Swiss banks to drop their neutrality. How damaging was that to American kind of trust and so on? Because my understanding is that in the international banking system, the safest of the safe, i.e. it doesn't matter if you're an African dictator, you can bank with the Swiss and be, you know, rest assured that your money is safe. But apparently, I mean, I remember it being a big deal at the time. Don't know what became of it, that the Biden admin were even leaning on the Swiss banks to be like, no, you have to seize Russian assets, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I can only imagine that stuff like that would cause ripples through pretty much every single country, right?
Yeah, so it's not just the Swiss. So the Swiss were are one keynote, but also the London City, Canada. The banking system of Canada is extremely strong, partially because of their dominance in that offshore dollar market, and they were there at the beginning with the UK. But you also have very, very strong node historically in Hong Kong, in Japan, in Tokyo, in Singapore, etc. And every time a node of this network, like European major players, the Swiss banks, when they do an action that reduces trust in the system by other players in the system, it fundamentally damages the possibility of the system to maintain dominance and to keep liquidity flows high. Like essentially the most important thing for them is like liquidity flows, more so than other like interest rates and things like this. Like they can play around those, but liquidity flows is key. Yeah, like when the Swiss were getting pressured and they were telling the ECB and the Americans not to do those those sanctions, it's because they know it will hurt their credibility in the system. And all of the financial experts, like working at those institutions, like the Bank of International Settlements and the IMF and all of those different institutions, the DTCC, they're pressuring political players not to do those types of moves because they know it fundamentally undermines the system. And it's very fragile.
The British government just straight seizing Russian assets. I mean, probably one that people will be aware of is Roman Abramovich, right? Owned Chelsea. Yeah. They effectively forced Roman Abramovich they seized Chelsea Football Club and were like, right, you know, we're taking that, mine. So this is essentially the British state acting like a kind of gangster, you know, mine, gimme, Russia bad, therefore your dollars belong to us now, or whatever, you know.
I mean, I mentioned in one article last year that since the turn of the 21st century, AA sanctions have increased by something ridiculous. It's like 900% or something. I can send you the link, actually. And this is a real problem because if all your assets are going to get sanctioned, then, you know, you need to look for other alternatives. But slowly and steadily, there has been, you know, a movement away from the dollar. You know, people are diversifying their foreign currency reserves into, you know, gold, precious metals, other currencies and whatnot. So I think, you know, I've argued before, there is a slow and steady realignment taking place, however you choose to view it, whether it's the BRICS nations, whether it's, you know, America losing credibility through the sanctions and whatnot. It's, you know, there is some, you know, there is a realignment taking place. I mean, speaking to what Dan said on your debate, you know, the problem is the wrecking ball theory. If the dollar is constantly rising, if it's just too strong, well, they're going to force other countries to look at other alternatives. They're going to force movement away from the dollar. And I think that this is where the economics really do play into, you know, the geopolitics of it all, because you know, if more and more demand is coming from particularly the Asian region, and, you know, they're already resource and commodity rich. I mean, you know, what's it to America and the West? I mean, they've been dictating terms and conditions for the last 70, 80 years, haven't they? You know, whether it's through the dollar or the World Bank, whether it's the commercial banks or whatnot. So they may turn around and start saying, well, we've had enough, you know.
One of the issues is, though, Nomad, is that in the MSM, and I've been an avid consumer of MSM since this whole debacle started, the standard line, if you listen to NBC, LBC or NBC or any of these outlets, BBC even, is that they've been saying, well, tariffs are the new sanctions. Tariffs are the new sanctions. This has been repeated over and over again. Trouble is that it's one thing when you're sanctioning Russia or Iran. It's another thing when you're trying to sanction the entire European Union or Great Britain or any other kind of quote-unquote allied nation. I mean, how is this going to just accelerate this movement away from the dollar?
Effectively, it will. I mean, the thing is with those MSM outlets, and actually, you know, if I might even say, you know, just Americans in general, be they academics, commentators, content creators, you know, that, you know, especially during the Reagan era, AA, it was all about, oh, well, you don't understand. Americans are creative and innovative, but they're also patriotic and they're also hardworking. And that's why we have, you know, such a successful economy. And that's why we have all these big companies and whatnot. And I would say, no, unfortunately, that's not the whole picture, you know. And if you want the real picture, you know, look at the $36 trillion in debt. Look at the twin deficits. You know, this is not possible without the central bank issued fiat currency system, you know, floating fiat currency system we've been under since 1971. It just just wouldn't be possible, because, you know, at the end of the day, that's what the American empire is built on. And other countries, whether it's Russia, whether it's Iran, whether it's China, and they can have successful companies and they can be resource rich. You know, America has the dollar at the end of the day, and Americans are fooling themselves. You see, Trump is clever because they always disguise it, AA, as, oh, you know, it's the foreigner, it's the other. Oh, yeah, we're being ripped off as usual. Oh, we thought the EU were our friends, but they're not. They're actually, you know, they're ripping us off as well. And China this and Mexico that. But, you know, they're disguising it in, I don't know if he's playing 4D chess, like we said on the Messenger, but I think that, you know, they always dress it up in those terms, whereas the reality is something I think a lot of Americans have a lot of trouble accepting. If I was to be a bit risque or...
one of the clips that did the round in the past week or so was Tim Cook of Apple saying, actually, it's not true that China have got a cheap labor market anymore.
Yeah.
And I had a look at the stats, and it's actually the wage growth since 1990 in China has been quite significant. Real terms, wage growth is pretty big. And in fact, the average wages in China are twice those in India, as an example. And he was saying, like, the reason that we still do stuff in China is because they have a skill base and an expertise base, and they actually know how to do this stuff. Okay,
they do.
Now, one of the interesting things was basically the American pushback on that, which I can only characterize as cope, I'm afraid. And I was even thinking when it came to, you know, I was thinking, well, what's the basis of comparison? But I remember growing up in this country, you know, there were Amstrad products, and there was we had a VCR recorder by Philips. Do you remember that company, Philips? You know, I remember growing up with those products. They weren't the be all and end all, you know, they weren't that like brilliant or anything. So I do wonder if it's just a little bit of kind of like, well, you know, our engineering's obviously the best. Our stuff equals high quality, China stuff equals tat. And then another debate broke out where I said, well, okay, do you associate the iPhones with low quality? And then tons of people were like, yeah, iPhone is low quality. I was like, well, what's an example of a high quality phone?
High quality, yeah.
Right? And they were like, well, Samsung, well, it's made in Vietnam. Google's phone, well, that's made in China. So it's like, well, actually, you're not talking about American made versus Chinese made. You're basically boasting over who's got the best sweatshop operation. You know, I mean, right. I just don't know, like, where the arguments are meant to go, because people.
That's very true. I mean, behind the scenes, it's no secret that the quality gap between, you know, America and, you know, like the, you know, like China, but also Mexico, has gotten smaller and smaller as the decades go on. I was reading about the NAFTA agreement that Clinton signed in, you know, in the mid 90s. And it was said at the time, you know, like Robert Rubin and all these people in the Treasury, that, look, it doesn't matter about, you know, sending the manufacturing base there, because they're just doing, you know, the dirty work. The fact is, we've got the expertise, we've got the technical base, and we'll always be they'll never be able to catch up on that. But even I've heard that even in Mexico, you know, the actual expertise sort of base has just grown, and the gap is like a lot smaller. Like, it manifests itself, AA Brulem, in, like, for example, the amount of time it takes to assemble a car or something on the plant. Or as Tim Cook was saying, you know, it is just the expertise. I remember, if I could monologue a little bit, I remember Hornby Trains, right? A British institution in some regions. I hope, you know, time stealer Alex or Steamgold back me up. I remember they had a Chinese consortium in the late 80s, right? And the Chinese gave this replica of a Hornby train, and like the execs at Hornby said, not only had they sort of done a good replica, they'd actually solved some of the structural problems with the original train. And they turned around and said, God, if this is an illustration of their ability and expertise, you know, they're going to basically just sort of take over manufacturing, you know, in the coming decades.
Yeah.
And so, basically, that's what happened, really, in no uncertain terms. But I mean, you know,
another thing to understand, because people dive into details of like who has better manufacturing capacity, things like this. And I mean, nowadays China has like more advanced manufacturing capacity than America, for instance, especially in like specific industries. But the question is not really like why is it that they have this now, this capacity, and can the Americans compare? It's more a matter of how did they get there. And part of it is because within the US, the regulation and regulatory oversight increased over time. And one of the key damaging movement was the like all the green initiatives. That's one very clear example. And also financial regulatory frameworks to constrain how they operate, essentially. So what you saw is that even the financial like banks, the investment banks and whatnot in the US were sending offshoring most of their investments and building this production capacity outside the US. This also happened in Europe. It also pushed a lot of their investments outside the US. And so they essentially built the production capacity. And you have historically like near slave labor in China building cheap stuff for the European and American market. And especially the US was paying for this with dollars that he quote unquote printed. And this is like a cycle that is very difficult to stop once it starts, especially with the dominance that they have in the liquidity markets worldwide, because everybody's reaching for dollars. So they'll accept quote unquote nothing dollars for something. So you see all the financial flows going offshore, heavily offshore. And then what you see that remains onshore is like very specific industries, and you see financialization. So just like layers of services. I just want to give a quick example because I think people might misunderstand me. I don't think that there shouldn't be any tariff or there should be tariffs. It's kind of it's quite sensitive. And my explanation of the offshore dollar system doesn't mean that they shouldn't apply tariffs. I think it's important for them to reshore manufacturing. And I'll take an example that's not in the US or not in China, just for people for me to give an example of like what that could look like. So there's key industries that I think must be protected for most countries. And a key example I can give, which I'm relatively familiar with, is in France, their agricultural production systems, like all the farms and the people growing like poultry and cattle and stuff. So they have like 2,000 farmers that are committing suicide per year. And they have many more than this that are trying to. And it's essentially because they have like immense problems in China, in France, to have their agricultural production be competitive in their market. Partly because since they entered the European Union, you have like in Ukraine and in like Eastern European nations that have much lower wages and much lower standards, environmental standards and production standards. They're competing with them internally in the system for like selling poultries and things like this. And this trend of the agricultural basis of France to be collapsing is accelerating because now they're discussing the Mercosur agreements so that like Brazil would be able to have free trade with the European Union. And they have even lower cost basis for their production and even worse environmental and, you know, like other, like, you know, factory farming and stuff like that. So that would completely like destroy France's agricultural production system. And that's been a pinnacle of France's economy for a long time. So this is a clear example of a space where France, if they cared about their people, would want to have some trade barriers, basically evaluate what are the production conditions like elsewhere and apply a tariff or some other method of economic barrier to force them to either produce at a similar level, provably, or just pay more to get into the market so that it makes it viable for the local people that are following their internal rules about production systems to be able to make their own, you know, farming viable. And I think this is also partly the explanation for defense and like national security concerns, things like this. And those are legitimate reasons to apply tariffs. I just, for my personal opinion, I just think that the way that Trump did it was like really, really bad. But I think there is like specific industries and cases where all those Western nations should be applying some forms of protection to key industries.
Absolutely. Tariffs aren't a bad thing. I mean, they're not uniquely a bad thing. I mean, AA mentioned, a lot of people have mentioned, for example, I've been in the Far East a lot. You know, if you go back to the last century, when the Asian tigers, you know, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, some of the Southeast Asian nations, when they were developing, you know, they would often have tariffs because at the end of the day, if you flood the market with imported products from overseas, you know, they're going to just, you know, they're just going to swamp the local domestic market, and then local manufacturers and producers won't be able to compete. You almost need that as a safety barrier until, you know, things kind of get better. But it depends on the context. You see, when you can't talk about tariffs, it depends on the background and the context of which you're sort of talking about. A lot of the time it's, you know, to protect local manufacturers. It isn't simply about penalizing. Yeah.
Nowhere in Frederick List does he say declare a trade war on the entire world and then cuck within a week. That is not, you know, everybody talks about Alexander Hamilton and 19th century and so on, but those guys were clever. They were targeted. They were strategic on which specific things they did for a particular purpose. Another bit of pushback I got was people say, well, AA, when Russia did this, when they were sanctioned and they switched to a wartime autarkic economy, you were like, rah, rah, Russia, look at them go type thing. The thing is, Putin had been planning that for 10, 20 years. He had already built up the manufacturing capacity to be able to switch to a wartime economy. He already had the infrastructure there, because guess what? Putin has been planning on these maneuvers since the late 90s, early 2000s. And even then, he didn't plan for every eventuality, right? I guess the strength of the sanctions was probably more than Putin was banking on, but he put himself into a position where he could do that. What Trump did is, without doing any of that preparatory work, just unilaterally declared that on every single nation in the world and then backtracked. And now he even backtracked on those strategic goods, which Dan was talking about, the superconductors, the electronic goods, on China, which is really one of the most pathetic things I've ever seen.
That was supposed to be the whole basis for... I'm still being told...
You know, when we're on the subject of electronics, I mentioned Philips. Obviously, somebody reminded me they were Dutch. When I was growing up, I had a TV like this, right? A Ferguson TV. It was wood. It was this exact model. I remember those little buttons there in the 80s when I was growing up. I watched Only Fools and Horses on a television like this made by Ferguson, okay? One of the other major copes that people are going to have to get over, Jack Dorsey, you know, the Twitter guy, tweeted out the other day, let's end IP. Let's end. One of the copes that people have is, well, the Chinese just stole this technology. They just stole it, okay? The way I look at it is, like, if you're playing Civilization, right, you have got so far on the tech tree. If another civilization reaches the same place on the tech tree, you can't claim IP on the wheel or on, like, it's that technology now exists in the world. You can't just say, oh, well, we own that tech forever. It doesn't work like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's what Apple tried to do with Samsung in their court case from 7-8 years ago. And they said the Samsung smartphone copied the Apple, and Apple said in their declaration, the shape is the same. And then they responded with, well, Apple didn't invent the rectangle. It's you know, it's silly. You know, you hear these sorts of things all the time, but they're also bad faith arguments.
But also fundamentally, the banking institutions and the companies are being pushed to offshore their industries and their, like, loans. And clearly these companies are setting up shop in China, and they're not going to be hiring like Americans and sending them to live in China at the salaries of the Chinese. They're hiring local people, so they need to share designs, and like to have a viable manufacturing capacity, you need to like know in detail how it works and how you can mass produce it. So when they say like they're stealing, I mean, they're literally sharing with them the designs, and then they're using this to start other businesses, which happens all the time in North America as well, historically. And the other thing to consider, just to tie into the Russia comment you made earlier, also Russia was like forced into that circumstance, and they've been working for solutions since 2005, 2008, similarly to most countries around the world, especially major economies. And they have a trading partner, namely China, that's their like border neighbor. So of course they're like a natural resource extractor nation, as well as a like pretty big manufacturing base. So they can send a lot of their resources, instead of sending it to like Europe, they can send it to China. So they have like alternatives. Canada, for instance, if they were put into like sanctions the same way Russia was, would completely collapse and would not be able to survive, because the entire like financial industry around Canada is set up to export goods and resources to the US, like 95% of our trade. So like Russia was in a very specific position to be able to quote unquote survive it. And even their key economics advisors and ministers and stuff were very worried when the sanctions initially hit, and they just managed to deal with it relatively well. And I think, like, I'm going to leave with this, but essentially, I think that all the Western nations need to figure out a way to have some protection around key industries. Like agriculture is a very specific good example, but also like national defense and key manufacturing capacity, especially if you're expecting to enter like World War III type scenarios. I just think that, to your point, like the way that Trump was doing it was really reckless. I've had conversations with Black Horse where he mentioned that it's likely that Trump has a very like weak alliance within his government, and he doesn't have the support of the like Democrats. So what he's doing is, by executive action, he's doing like really, really big steps and then dropping down lower to something that's viable. And he doesn't have the capacity or bandwidth to actually do like a saner plan, where he's doing like a small incremental steps and kind of like giving insight to all of those manufacturers that like, okay, this year is going to be 3%, next year is going to be 6%, and you know, every year we're increasing by 3% tariffs up to a cap of like 25% and things like this, because he's going to be fought in the US to like destroy those types of more sensible type of, you know, plans. And he's not, and he wasn't mentioning this, and I was having a conversation with him. It's not to excuse the way he's done it. It was really like poorly done, but it's just a possible reason for why he's doing it like this way, because he doesn't have actually a very strong coalition.
Yeah, I've heard that there's a pretty big split between, I guess, what you'd call GOP swamp neocon types and like nationalists within his coalition. He's struggling to keep the band together at the minute. Alistair Crook said that this morning or yesterday on Judge Knapp, for example. So Trump is in a pretty difficult spot within his actual base and within his coalition as well, trying to keep these different things happy. Well, anyway, Brulaham, if you have to go, thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And if you are willing to have me back later, it's going to be my pleasure. Thank you.
Cheers, Brulaham. Before we get to the super chats, Nomad, anything you want to add on this topic?
Not really. I think we covered a lot of ground. It was a bit abstract at certain points, but all I'll say in summing up is, you know, I think there is a slow and steady realignment moving away from the dollar, but I think these are uncertain times, really. I don't know how this is going to play out or long term, what this is going to mean for the global monetary system. But I think overall it's inevitable, really, whether it's based on the strength of the dollar or the fact that, you know, the dollar is, you know, has an outsized role in global terms relative to the size of the US, and the fact that US GDP is increasingly, you know, representing a smaller and smaller share of global GDP. This system was constructed when the US was the top dog militarily, politically, economically. But, you know, that moment has changed, as we often cover AA. You know, that moment has passed. And I think a new era beckons, really. That's what I'd say.
All right, great. Well, let's hit a few. Are you going to stick around for super thanks, super chats?
I'll stick around there. Yeah, I'll stick around. No worries.
All right, let me pull up super thanks first of all.
Couple of big ones.
Okay. Well, super thanks first of all. Okay. So from last week's office hours, there was thinking that Americans can't work in manufacturing again is as absurd as the idea that white women in the West can't bear children anymore. Just because they don't so much doesn't mean they can't that they can't change and quickly. Any thoughts on that, Nomad?
It depends in what sector. I think it's hard to say. It's a bit of a hard sell. It's certainly not going to happen overnight. I mean, they've hollowed out most of the Midwest and the manufacturing sector. So I think they could bring, I was thinking about this when you were doing the debate, actually, maybe if it was at scale, I don't think they could, but if it's specific, you know, targeted strategic products, inputs and whatnot, components, possibly they could, but, you know, I think it very much depends. My instinctive reaction is no, not immediately, and not without great upheaval and you know, problems, you know, foreseen and unforeseen, you know, getting in the way. So I'm not too confident on that, if I'm being honest.
This is on Slopulism, five tricks populists use to manipulate followers. I've gone from an Alex Jones MAGA boy in 2020 to fully concurring with everything you said in this video in 2025. A few years can change you a lot if you're actually willing to admit that you had it wrong, or at least knew less before than you did now, through just observing what is happening in front of you. Sadly, 80% plus of the population, I think, have almost no ability to do this. The bleak-looking future makes it more important than ever, in my opinion, to have things you're passionate about above all else that can drown out all this noise, to give 100% commitment to them. I am an aspiring kickboxer, and I change my walkout song each fight. I'm sure I did that one before. Did I not? I feel like I did that one before. I could be wrong. I feel like I've read this one. Let me just double check, because I did an unscheduled office hours, didn't I? Yes, on the 10th. That was 5 days ago, so I must have done that one already. I'll skip that. Skip these. I'm going to go from this one. This is Studio Rayner. Why don't you start an academic institution called the Academic Agency and also charge $500,000 tuition for teaching future world leaders? This is on Deepest Law 117, Rewriting Jordan Peterson's Conservative Manifesto. Also, online courses suck. They don't suck. Mine in particular are absolutely phenomenal and are probably worth more than your typical in-person university course. So I don't agree with that. Why don't I start one and charge $500,000 for tuition? Well, if you want to trump up the startup capital for buying a university campus, you know, you can be my guest, Studio Reyna. He also says three reasons why, and also the maintenance overhead costs of running such a place as well. Three reasons why Israel supports Donald Trump. That video, same person says, have you noticed that the financial managerial elites seem more interested in doing business with Iran than in a war with Iran, Obama, Epstein, etc.? We watched Trump forced to comply with financial managerial elites when he tried to implement tariffs. Who wins, the financial managerial elites or the neocons? That will decide whether there's a war with Iran or not. Well, one interesting thing that happened is that when Netanyahu went to meet Trump in the Oval Office, he mentioned that they were in direct talks with Iran. And apparently Netanyahu's face kind of dropped in that moment as if he hadn't been told. So, I mean, if you want my assessment, I think that the Iranian regime is spooked at the minute. I think they were spooked when the president was, quote-unquote, died in a, quote-unquote, helicopter accident. I think they were spooked by the Assad thing as well. And I think that they have basically quietly cucked behind the scenes. That's my reading of the scenario. The Ayatollah can run his mouth all day long. I feel like the Iranian regime wants to normalize and want to drop all of this. That's my sense. I could be wrong. I also don't get the impression that Trump really wants a war with Iran either. So I wouldn't be surprised if nothing ever happens on that front. It's the Israelis who want that war. And regardless of how much leverage the Israelis have within American politics, for whatever reason, it never happens. You can go back to Biden's speeches in 2008, where he's talking about the war with Iran, and it never actually comes to fruition. Why that is hard to say, but my suspicion is that there are dudes in the Pentagon, Douglas McGregor type, not Douglas McGregor himself, but people like him, who are just realists, just basically telling the president, whoever's the president, listen, boss, we can't do this. The war would be too big. It would cost thousands of American lives. This is not going to be like a Gulf War-like scenario. This would be a very difficult war, especially if the Russians and the Chinese agree to help the Iranians. So I think there's incentives on both sides for this war not to take place. I think the Iranian regime are spooked and are bricking it as we speak. And I think that the American regime, whether it's Trump or Biden or anyone else, basically don't want to do this. The Israelis do want to do it. But that's been their ultimate for the past 20 years. And they still haven't been able to make it happen. So there we are. I still bet on nothing ever happens on that. Studio Reyna, also on further implications of managerial capitalism, a very old video of mine, says a future historian will view the world as totalitarian, caused by the Industrial Revolution's ability to function primarily through a managerial system. As a Zoomer, I see this system as broken down for our generation, which rejected it. Zoomers suffer from depopulation, in intentional incompetence, and various mental illnesses hindering managerial growth. Unless the freedom of global war comes, forces a new status quo, that is the fate of this generation. Trouble is, Studio Reyna, the boomers thought that the system of capital would break on their backs. It didn't. Their cultural revolution basically ended up with boomers being dragooned en masse into office jobs and becoming status quo men. Same thing had happened to Gen X. Every generation has its quote-unquote rebellion, and it ends up with nothing. I remember all of the headlines, millennials are causing problems in the workplace, yada, yada, yada. Now the millennials are the managers, and they're saying the same things about the Zoomers. Oh, we can't work with these Zoomers. They're causing too much trouble. Fast forward 10 years, 20 years, the Zoomers will be the managers saying the exact same thing. So, I have become skeptical of any analysis that is based on the character of this generation or that generation. Every generation is encouraged to have its kind of youthful rebellion, and then every generation is crushed under the boot of Big Brother, unfortunately. You know, I'd love to be proven wrong, but I just don't see any evidence of it. RJ's 39311 says, "Hi, AA, this is Discover the Secret of Understanding the English People. My gosh, if you want to hear bad French pronunciation, watch that video." But a lot of people enjoyed that video a lot. He says, "Hi, AA, appreciate you helping me cut my diet of slop to a minimum over the last few years. To continue this, what are your personal favorite channels that you constantly watch to inform yourself? Any particular news channels as well? Appreciate the generally level head." I watch Judge Knapp. I watch Duran. I watch, I've recently started watching The Rest is Politics on LBC. I watch War Strike. I watch Devin Stack. I watch always Morgoth. If he puts out a video, I'll watch Morgoth. Who else? Dickie Spencer, I always watch. That's kind of it. But by the time I've gone through those, I've got very little else time left. Typically, I'll stick them on when I'm driving. So I've managed to catch like stolen 50 minutes here and there when I'm in my car. But I often finish shows.
I've really toned down my content consumption. I barely get to listen to yours, AA. It's just been a slow year stream-wise. It doesn't seem to be as many around now. But I think you're definitely right, Judge Knapp, the Duran, Mark and Frody.
Mark and Frody, I watch them every week as well, to be fair, yeah.
I just wish I had more time, and, you know, I don't. And it's annoying because, you know, we miss those days. But, you know, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, just because I listen to any one of those shows doesn't mean I endorse them. I like to have a spectrum of what people are talking about across the board, you know. And generally, those ones I just mentioned give me a flavor, what MSM is saying, what, you know, what various different spheres are saying. And then when it comes to, you know, what the kind of slopper sphere is saying, I can just look at my Twitter timeline. I don't really need to, you know, waste hours, you know, listening to the slop. So yeah. What else? How Farage, like the Tories, will be always willing to betray you. That was from earlier today. D Recrescent says, AA, you say Tories reform will always betray you. So how are we ever gonna get right wing change in the UK? Ex Tory, now reform member. Well, you're not going to do it by voting for any of those parties, I tell you that much, right? Personally, I don't think there will be a I mean, look, it's basically like imagine you're somebody who's against the communism in Russia, and you're basically saying, look, I don't like any of these. Comrade Stalin has died. But I don't like the looks of this Khrushchev. I don't like the looks of Khrushchev or Brezhnev or Andropov or any of these guys. How are we ever going to get out of this when these are the options we are given, right? You have to look at it that way. The system is not going to give you an option that is going to bring down itself. I always remember one of the serious things Curtis Yarvin once said is, like, you've got to think of yourself as living in Soviet Russia, right? So it's like, you're not gonna, system's not gonna throw up options. And this is where the Trump equals Gorbachev thing is even more fitting, because like he's genuinely trying to do some reforms, but you know what happened. Alphonse Rides Again says, this is on the same video, How Farage, Like the Tories Will Always Betray You. Regarding Farage's concession speech on the night of Brexit, there was a theory among the left at the time that UKIP has started as an EU Parliament expenses scam that got out of hand. The party that was there to exploit Middle England's anti-EU feelings to cash in on Brussels' expense allowance seemed daft at the time, but now it sounds plausible. Yeah, maybe. Hard to know. I still think that a lot of the forces behind Brexit were actually money men, global markets men, who kind of always had this idea that they could sell it to the public as this patriotic thing. They kind of got lucky with winning it. And lo and behold, we got the more global Britain that we voted for. Hobby says, AA, are you for, this is on what's really going on in the trade war between USA and Canada, slightly older video. He says, AA, are you familiar with the concept of the Red Tory? A good primer is Ron Dart's The North American High Tory Tradition. It goes over the success and then the failure of the elite of the Canadian right, intellectuals, military, old imperial and populist, to resist American economic and cultural colonization, liberalism and libertarianism. As we are all trying to resist American colonialism, looking at the oldest movement of resistance may provide some lessons for today for all. Perhaps a video to petition Black Horse to prepare? Well, I know absolutely nothing about Canadian politics. My knowledge of Canadian politics basically extends to Bret Hart promos in the mid-90s. And I wish I was joking, but I'm not. do you remember when Bret Hart had his little heel run there? that is the beginning and the end of my Canadian politics knowledge. So, Black Horse, if you're watching, mate, concept of the Red Tory, or Mike Maxwell, or any of the other Canadian patriots that we know, I'd love to know about some of that, because it's a vast unknown country, is Canada, to most of us.
I think Bret Hart and pro wrestling is my reference point for basically all of Canada.
Well, there was the Mountie, of course, and Strongman Dino Bravo as well.
Quite a few, actually. Yeah, when you go through it, it's. I didn't know, I did after a while, but Piper from Saskatchewan. There's a lot of celebrities, not just wrestlers, that the Canadian Pamela Anderson. Is it Ryan Reynolds?
Really?
Pamela Anderson's
Canadian. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know Jim Neidhart was American, though.
Unbelievable.
I found that out last week. He was born in California.
Wow. Yeah. Well, he was a fake member of the Hart family, wasn't he? Didn't he marry in or something?
Yeah, but there was also Brian Pillman who joined the Hart Foundation, but he was obviously he's obviously American. But so there's quite a few that, go back and forth, I guess. But,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean the British Bulldog was part of the Hart family as well. Bizarrely, didn't he marry?
Yeah, he married Diana. He married their sister. Diana Hart, of course. But of course, they're all dead now. Anvil, Davy Boy, Brian Pillman, Owen. It's pretty sad. Have you seen that? Done that before, eh? When you watch WrestleMania matches from the golden era, everyone involved is no longer with us. It's happens.
I know. It's kind of weird. Entire cards, people dead, and then you look at it and you think, yeah, but if Kurt Hennig had lived, he'd only be like 60 or something. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Brett is still with us, though, isn't he?
Yeah, Brett, see, he's not doing bad, really, because at one point he was looking, after the stroke and whatnot, he was looking a bit fragile, but he still does streams, but if that counts.
He's a bitter old sod, though, isn't he, Brett?
Really bitter. I mean, there's a popular video, it's called Bret Hart Buries the World, and this is where he basically takes down anyone who's anyone. He's pretty bitter, but I don't know. I think that the whole wrestling stream lore, we could do another separate stream about that sometime, actually, because I just think it's kind of gotten out of control, where everyone, no matter where, even jobbers will have like a podcast now and they're like, yeah, I got the inside info.
Yeah, I found my favorite one was the jobber Mario Mancini from the mid-80s. I don't know if you remember him. Like, Mario Mancini had a podcast at one point.
What did Rene Dupree think of Hollywood Hogan? It's like, you know, no one cares. Like,
all right, Studio Reina in the super chat says, I've noticed that since the war between NATO and Russia began, that everything has become more expensive. Do you think that Russia is simply defeating the US in a hybrid war? Putin is KGB like Yuri Bezmenov, so he should know how to win. Any thoughts on that, Nomad? Is this part of like a KGB genius plan to bring down the West on behalf of Putin?
Yeah, I mean, you hear that a lot. I mean, what I would, I don't know, I really try not to play into the conspiracy side of the theory cells, but what you said 10 minutes ago when you said Putin is kind of a master at planning long term, whereas I don't think the West, particularly the Americans, are, to be honest with you. They just think US hegemony is, you know, going to go on forever. But like you said, Putin has been running through these scenarios for quite a long time, to be honest, whether it's, you know, re-engineering Russia's manufacturing capacity to be, you know, produce on a wartime footing or whatever it is. I don't know if it's a big sort of thing to bring down.
I'll just say, if I was Russian, I'd be heavily leaning into culture war slop. Funding and leaning into culture war slop. And I'm pretty sure that's what they've been doing, the Russians. I'm pretty sure that populism and Russian money are quite intertwined, not just in America, but everywhere. So that's what I would say. But I wouldn't be like, if you found out that a lot of the woke guys were secretly funded by Russia, you wouldn't be that surprised either, would you? Right?
No.
With Yuri Bezmenov in mind.
No, you wouldn't. I was going through some of your, I'm not up to date with your stuff, AA, but I do love the Adam Curtis commentary you, Simon, and Horace do. And what is it, Carnegie? I can't remember. He's got so many. The one where he talks about the viral content factories that were produced, you know, to sort of manipulate emotions and feelings and responses, but also the discourse more broadly. I mean, I think the Chinese, the Indians are quite, you know, adept at this, you know, so I think everyone's in on the game. It's like Curtis says, you can't tell, you know, fiction from reality if you're too beholden to the digital realm. You know, past a certain point in the sand, you can't distinguish the two apart. So, I mean, you're pretty good on the Indian bots, which is good if they spam your
ex. Well, there was this guy who was arguing with me about Trump trade tariffs, and I noticed like he had been replying basically for like 12 hours straight, and then I noticed he was like, if you go through his replies, all he does is reply to Europeans talking about Trump trade tariffs. So I was like, this guy's awfully invested. But then I benchmarked his times and I pulled him up on it. I said, excuse me, sorry to pry, but like, what were you doing up at like 4 a.m? He was like, oh, I was working late. I was like, oh yeah, what sort of job have you got working late, which requires you to spend like, and then like from 4 a.m. all the way for 12 hours, like 9 p.m. the next night, this guy was
hosting this.
Yeah. So then I went through an entire week noting his gaps. And then I got a bunch of people to check Grok to be like, what would these gaps, sleeping times, be consistent with? And they all said, oh, well, this would be consistent with not somebody living in the Rust Belt, but somebody living in India. And lo and behold, I was blocked after that, after pulling him up. So it's funny how that goes. So a very, very many such cases. And I this is a problematic, of course, because increasingly on Twitter, and this is really since the Elon Musk era, you don't know if the person you're talking to is a bot, is an Indian, somebody who's genuine or not. And this causes chaos and dissension because you don't like it really feels like, oh, why is this guy going at me? So, oh, actually, it's a guy in a call center. You know what I mean? So it's kind of annoying. But then you have to ask, well, who's paying for that? Has Team Trump paid? So many thousands of Indians to just have a go at people online, you know?
We're living in a permanent Adam Curtis documentary, you know, hyper-reality of, the normal.
Yeah, I mean, I should have picked up, like, nobody says, oh, I live in the Rust Belt. Real Americans say, like, oh, I'm from Ohio or whatever, you know? Anyway, Mr. EW says, what about the CHF as a new world reserve currency?
That's never going to work because he's talking about the Swiss franc, the CHF, because at the end of the day, you know, Switzerland is, what, 7 million people? You can't really build a reserve currency around an isolationist country, you know, whose population is, you know, less than London's. It just doesn't work like that, really, because how would you assemble the system? How are you going to manage it? How are you going to prevent hyperinflation? I mean, how are you going to absorb all those, it's a very difficult situation. What comes next in terms of reserve currencies and reserve currency status? I mean, some people have talked about a kind of, you know, what the IMF had, it was called SDRs, special drawing rights. So Keynes, AA, during the Bretton Woods Accords, he said, look, if the dollar system overheats, we could have like a parallel one, a backup one, almost a bit like gold. But of course, gold is not, you know, is static and is finite. So they had this other thing called the special drawing rights, which would be overseen by the IMF. But the Americans voted it down. Morgenthau and Dexter White, they you know, disagreed with it. They said they wanted the dollar installed as the primary reserve currency. But it's difficult because, you know, like the BRICS, they keep on adding members, right? Well, what people don't understand is the more countries that join the BRICS alliance, the harder it is to get a exchange rate mechanism to balance out all the countries. I mean, how do you do it? I mean, because everybody's economy operates at a different scale.
The classic EU problem, the classic Euro problem, of course.
Yeah, it's a problem. It was initially a problem with the Euro till they stabilized it, and they kept on growing, didn't they? Adding more countries, Eastern Europe, the B states, the Baltic and Eastern European states, and so on and so forth. But it's a delicate thing. It's a finely balanced one. Of course, the second oil crisis, which came as a result of the Iranian hostage situation, the OPEC states suggested, look, why don't we just have a basket of currencies? Because the Japanese were one of the strongest economies at the time before they reunified West Germany. There was a British pound, there was a Swiss franc. But every time America just keeps on voting it down, really. So I don't know what to do. The East Asian countries, they have strong capital controls. They don't like large volumes of their own currency building up overseas, much like what has happened with the US dollar, with the euro dollar. Marcus Bruin was talking about in the beginning. They're very suspicious of that because it's outside of their control. So I don't know, you know, there's not enough gold in the world. I think if you add up all the gold in circulation, AA, it comes up to about 12 trillion. Well, that's nowhere near, you know, global GDP. You're miles off it. So here we are, you know, it's difficult. It's difficult. The alternatives to the dollar are just few and far between. So I don't know. It's a hard one. And one final thing I would say, sorry, one thing you've got to understand in terms of like 4D chess, the Russians, the Chinese, all these entities, the Indians, the OPEC countries, all their wealth is in dollars. Their asset portfolio, mainly dollars or dollar denominated assets. So, you know, that Greek chap, Yanis Varoufakis, that guy, he's sometimes on Question Time. Do you know the one I mean? The one who looks like Voldemort.
Yeah, I've seen him, yeah.
Yeah, as he says, you know, the elites don't want the system to end because their wealth is in dollars. So, you know, you're kind of checkmating yourself in a way if you get rid of the dollar system. But because people don't trust the yuan and the PBOC and the G. They don't trust Putin and the Kremlin and whatnot. So, you know, you're stuck. You're back at square one. You're back at square one. So, I don't know.
Chris Brimer says, I like the work by Jeff Snyder, but he can get lost in the weeds at times, or all the time, depending on his critics. Daniel Hall says, does China actually want to replace the dollar reserve system? It would be forced to stop artificially lowering its currency, and it would have to take on an American-like trade deficit. Why would it?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, China, one thing, look, there's a lot to say on America. In China, yeah, you probably do a whole stream on that alone. But I mean, there's no doubt about it. You know, I'm a fairly vocal critic of America and the dollar system. But, you know, Chinese prosperity and growth and strength has been built on the back of the dollar system and the trade with the US. But there are problems, obviously, because China has to keep their currency artificially low in order to maintain the dollar peg, because they kind of have an informal peg with the dollar. So it's very, if they were to break away from that, it's kind of difficult to know what they would do, But of course they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, because it's very difficult for them to improve living standards if the currency is, you know, consistently undervalued. The other thing is there's a lot of issues in China. I mean, for example, a lot of people in the rural provinces, you know, the ones that are less prosperous, that rely on agriculture, you know, they say their wages are artificially lowered in order to keep the cost of Chinese goods down, whether that's in manufacturing or agriculture. So this is an issue again. So I don't know, does Xi and the, you know, the, is it the poly? Oh, sorry, G and the Chinese elites. What? How do they feel of this? I'm not sure. They own loads in America. They own property. I don't know if you saw that meme last week, about the farmland that China owns in America. They've got all kinds of assets and investments in the United States. So I think it's, you know, you're jumping the gun of saying, oh, everybody wants it over. I think people want more stability, but it's hard to know how to achieve that, really, whether you're China or you're Europe or whoever, Mexico or Brazil, whatever. It's hard, yeah.
For $100, speaking of US dollar hegemony.
Not such a critic now. Oh, yeah.
Kuna Trolling says, the USA only cares about the bond market because that's the only thing propping up the US dollar as a valued currency. They thought that investors would buy treasuries when the market tanked from the tariffs and long-term interest rates would fall. They didn't, though. Yes, absolutely.
Very true. Yeah,
you know, this super 4D chess genius Scott Bessent wasn't banking on it. And if you watch tomorrow's video, you can see what he said the day before it happened and then what he said the day after it happened. Studio Rainer says, what's the difference between an economist and a fraudster?
Don't know.
About 100K, probably.
Okay.
Yeah. Studio Rainer says, depends on the economist and depends on the fraudster, I suppose. Studio Rainer says, all he had to say was, the economy is the elite term for a pyramid scheme. It's overly complex to hide how simple it is. Is that true, Nomad?
You know, I think to a lot, I kind of think it is, really. I think, again, I hate to sound like a, you know, a broken record, but, you know, just keep coming back to that landmark moment in 1971, you know, when we came off the gold standard, it all went kaplunk. And it's like, you know, some people have said, I think, I don't want to say, I think Radlib definitely has said this as well. You know, the dollar isn't just tied to oil or US treasuries or anything. It's also tied to debt because we have a debt-based system, and we need debt because we need people to constantly, you know, be invested in the system. You know, even if you're borrowing, you're on credit cards or whatever. And you know, there's certainly a large consensus that we have essentially a Ponzi scheme of sorts. You know, you might take different, you know, descriptions. There are different manifestations of it, but essentially, you know, as most people are in debt, we do, because debt keeps the system running. So I don't know, it's about perspective, that one, you know, but I kind of think it is, really. I'm meant to believe it is. So
Cody says, do you think a potential BRICS currency would be a form of digital gold?
Would be a form of what gold? Judicial.
Digital.
Digital. It's really difficult. SBDC or, you know, gold, it's very hard. I mean, that has been floated, but I honestly don't know about that one. I'm not sure. I just think it's hard for BRICS because the more and more countries that join, again, it's that same problem, the exchange rate mechanism. How are you going to find an equilibrium for every country, from Egypt to Indonesia, from Chile, you know, to India? How are you going to put them all on the same thing? I mean, the logical thing for me, AA, would be to use the yuan, the Chinese yuan. But China, they don't seem very keen on that idea, even if it is just the BRICS. So I don't know if it's some kind of digital backed gold or digital currency. I'm not sure. But I'm not very up on the whole digital currencies thing. It's another layer to an already complex kind of pyramid we've got. But
Coney says, a question I asked Dan Tubbs last week: what would a potential Mar-a-Lago exchange rate accord look like, possibly with the US forcing vassal states to peg their currency to the dollar?
That's also quite, I mean, we can only speculate. I mean, you know, I just don't know if there is a bit of 4D chess going on here, because, you know, Dan, what I was going to say back to the debate, Dan is right. There does have to be a change at some point. And maybe Trump and his administration realize that it's not going to go on forever. The debt can't keep going up and up and up. You know, at some point, especially with the rollover for the COVID inflation, and also the fact that the dollar just keeps growing in strength, at some point it's going to come to an end. And maybe if you're being a bit cutthroat, Trump's going to get around the table and he's going to be like, look, you're either with us or you're not. I mean, since World War II, it's been us that's been carrying the baggage, all the growth and prosperity. A lot of it has been based on this system. Now, you want to say that, you know, we've got control over all the levers of the global economy and we've got an unfair advantage. Okay, maybe you're right. But at the end of the day, you know, we've also got the burden too. So what's it going to be, EU? What's it going to be, Britain? In Europe, you really want to go to China? You see, it's like you said the other day, it's like somehow, some way, they always find a way round of coming back into the American gambit, don't they? US's orbit, whether it's geopolitical or whether it's financial and economic. And I don't think it will change this time round. I don't think we're ready to go cozy up to G and whatnot. So I think it will be a very real politic kind of Mearsheimer style conversation that unfortunately we won't be privy to. I think it will be dressed up in different terms in the international media and the MSM, as it always is, of course. But I think, you know, there's going to be some hard, you know, conversations behind closed doors about, you know, where we're going. In all this, I mean, it's not like Europe is doing great anyway. You know, we got deficits, we got budget deficits. I mean, you know, this country just gets worse and worse. I mean, the pothole roads, you can't get a doctor's appointment, you can't do anything here. So I don't know if we're ones to talk. There's Nord Stream, there's a Ukraine war, there's a lot of things that go into it, man. I mean, you can't, there's a lot of push and pull factors, but Europe can barely stand up by itself. I don't know what you think about that.
My honest view is, looking at what's happening, the EU will use the situation as an attempt at a power play and will actually go some step of the way towards China. Mm-hmm. But Britain, because of Brexit, won't. Britain will stay with America, but Europe will try to go towards China. It's already started to happen. Why? Because Britain doesn't have the power on its own, so it will stay in the American orbit, whereas Europe, because of the EU, does have that power. That's my personal view.
You're right. I mean, one thing I'd say on a related point, I think last year, we talked a bit about this book by Angus Hanton, the writer, you know, Vassal State.
Vassal State.
How America Runs Britain. It's a great book for anyone that's listening, for our listeners. It's not a particularly difficult, it's like 230 pages. It's very lucid, easy to read. And he actually makes the point that there's actually a big gap between Britain and Europe in that AA. America has a lot more control and influence over the UK than even a lot of the Western, even the other Western European countries. It has quite a lot over Germany, but then Spain, France, you know, these countries, it's a bit more marginal. It's certainly less of a footprint.
Britain was America's point man in Europe.
When
Brexit happened, that lessened America's control over Europe. And there's just that's why since Brexit, the locus of power and focus has switched from the European Union back to NATO, if you notice that. You know, that's basically what's happened. So,
and there's a historical precedent for that. If you go back through time, you know, when de Gaulle and was it Willy Brandt of West Germany, when they wanted to break away, it was always Britain that was, you know, kind of speaking up for America.
I personally think that people, Americans, Brits alike, are too quick to write off Europe, right? Mm-hmm. There are all these blasé kind of analyses. Europe has fallen, Europe's become a caliphate, Europe is irrelevant. I mean, on paper, Europe has got decent manufacturing capacity, big population.
Yeah.
You know, it's on paper, it's not looking too bad. And it's demographics, if you take Britain out of the equation as well, its demographics are in way better shape than America's, way better shape. So I still think that people are too fast, too quick to write off Europe as an entity. That's my personal view, but we'll see. We'll see what happens in the future. Cringe Walker says, we can manufacture high tech here, but it's going to take a boatload of subsidies to compete with slaves.
Yeah, there's so many. Exactly. I mean, as I say, when it comes to the manufacturing capacity, if it's very specific things that you don't need large quantities of, maybe they've got a chance. America may even already have some contingency plan for that. But at scale, you know, if you're talking like everything on Amazon and things, you know, all the tap they buy, I mean, I just don't see they can't have a plan in place for that, because that's going to take decades, you know. And, you know, it's not just, you know, the tangible inputs, it's a changing culture as well. I mean, where are you going to get that manufacturing base from? It's been knocked out, it's been hollowed out since, well, where to start, at least since NAFTA onwards, you know. So I don't know how exactly. It's going to have to be a long-term plan. Both the Democrats and Republicans, they're going to have to be behind it. They can't afford for Congress to get in the way, you know. They're going to have to mobilize nationwide. I just don't see how they can do it, really. They've got to compete with the low wages, but also the running costs. The utilities are much cheaper in Mexico, much cheaper in China, and whatnot. There's wages, but there's also benefits as well. Healthcare is always a problem for Americans, and, you know, workers' rights. All of these things have to be considered, and there is the skill thing. So it depends what we're talking about, but there's no way it's going to be done overnight. It just isn't. You, like you said, AA, back of a fag packet kind of calculations. You know, that's not the level we're talking at here. You know, you're talking about the global supply chain. You're talking about vertically integrated networks of you know, products and, you know, processes, which are at their heart, you know, they're very technical, you know, they're very, very complicated. So I just don't see how, where you start, unless they've already begun, but I could be wrong, but, you know, it's difficult, you know.
Hammond says, AA dark crystal analogy of death creep accurate? Unfortunately, I mean, I know what the dark crystal is, AA Hammond. I do not know what death creep is, I'm afraid. Sam153 says, you're correct that it feels that MAGA jumped the shark. Is the quote-unquote online right splitting over this tarot issue, or is it just kayfabe? Well, thank you very much, Sam153. It means so much. No, I don't think the online right is split. I just think that the online right is the same as it's always been. Only some portion of it have just become magatars. That's all it is. Anybody kind of worth a damn it sees this for what it is, as far as I can see. So Full Spectrum Submission says, who is the hidden hand cock-blocking actual opposition in the UK? Even our people seem to have been convinced these are organic developments once again. I don't know who the hidden hand is, Full Spectrum Submission. I mean, the person who seems to make a lot of things tick is, of course, Old Tone. He has been all over my social media timeline today due to his evil outlining of digital ID plans.
Saw that. Yeah.
Did you see that? Maybe people haven't seen Tone's latest, but he's all over the place because he just released. In fact, if I find it, Tony Blair Institute. There he is yet again. In person, and a lot of people have been saying that he doesn't look well, that that evil has taken its toll on the Dark Lord. But let's have a little watch.
We cannot continue with business as usual, and change is inevitable. This is where technology like digital ID becomes critical. My institute's own analysis shows that introducing this in the UK would save at least $2 billion a year, and likely more, by reducing losses to fraud, improving tax collection, and better targeting of state support.
There it was.
We cannot continue with business as usual.
Just a quick message from him.
And change.
Just a quick message from him. There we go. Basically, if you did the Tony, do you remember in those magazines where there used to be those flow charts? You know, is it this? Yes, no. And for Blair, it doesn't matter what the issue is. All arrows lead back to digital ID. Studio Rainer says, why can't cryptocurrency become a reserve if the math checks out? It should work out. Or do they just not want to because they can't do the fraud? The thing is that you're talking about the entire world's economy. You can't just change that overnight. Like, what's the mechanism to flick it to cryptocurrency? I mean, it's very difficult to do that, because these holdings exist in institutions, in massive companies and so on. It would disrupt all factors of life. So it'd be very difficult to make that change. What people would have to do is to see actually what happened when they tried to implement various other changes. Do you remember when they went off the gold standard and they went back on the gold standard and, what actually happened in the short run when those things happen? People would have to look at that. Studio Arena says digital IDs are coming to the US. I think Tony Blair might control the US too, at least in terms of digital IDs. Please stop him. Well, I mean, as I said in a video, the Trump administration is in with Larry Ellison, who is the principal funder of Blair. So exactly like through the Tech Bro Alliance with MAGA, the exact same thing will happen in America. Only when they do it over there, because it's got a red hat on it, you know, it'll be like, oh, this is the basest 4D chess ever, you know, which is an ideal way to sell, you know, whatever it is. This is why I said you've got to always look beyond the baby face and heel politics, because, you know, the exact same thing. And one of the things I've noticed is that more and more people are saying, well, what's so bad about digital ID? Why are you against it? Those voices have increased. Mary Harrington wrote an actual essay in Unheard saying how I learned to stop worrying and love digital ID. So, you know, it's all like the persistence of tone has paid off in the long run. He's ground everybody down to acceptance at this point. Herlock Sholmes says, what do you think of the theory that China's population is much smaller than official statistics say? Nomad, you've actually been over there. Any truth to it?
I think it's, it's interesting. I don't know if it's smaller. I mean, one thing is they are in net population decline. I mean, schools are closing. You know, they can see this in the economy. You know, effective demand is down and whatnot. It does. It's always a bit strange because you say, well, it's 1.3 billion people. Is it going to matter? Well, are you even going to notice? But it is happening. You know, the elderly population is growing. Chinese have to start investing more into, you know, services and provisions for the elderly, you know, whether it's healthcare or whatever. And it's hard, especially such a massive country. It's so huge, getting out into those rural provinces, you know, delivering services there. It's quite, you know, it's challenging. So I don't know if it's less than what they're estimating, but I definitely think, you know, there are some demographic issues. You know, they are in net decline. But, so,
I mean, I'm old enough, Nomad, and here's my one-shot response to Peter Zahan and all these other types who've been going on about this.
Yeah.
I mean, they had the one-child policy from 1979 to 2015. So you institute a one-child policy, and then you're like, oh, the population's going down. Well, no shit, Sherlock. Why? I mean, they must have had a reason for doing the one-child policy.
Yeah,
they must actually have wanted to decrease the population at some point. So presumably this is in their 5-year, 10-year plan or whatever. What was the actual thinking in the first place behind the one-child policy? And therein will be the answer, surely. Am I making this up? I mean, why else do the one-child policy? They must have been like, yeah, the population's too big. We want to reduce it for some reason.
Yeah, they definitely want to control the population growth and whatnot. I mean, obviously, I suppose that would be under the Deng era. It's a bit of again, same thing we say for the West and America. The paradigm has changed. You know, that moment has passed and we're sort of in a new.
But they kept it in place till 2015.
It's a long time. Yeah, it is. Yeah. I meant when it was, you know, when it was founded. But to be fair, they could have repealed it before then. So, no, your point holds. But, I'm not sure, like on the ground, you know, how it's playing out there. But, yeah, they have issues as well, I suppose, as well in China. So, yeah, we'll have to keep an eye out for that one. But it definitely an interesting subject to, you know, dote on, that's for sure.
All right, and I think that is it. Studio Rainer says, is Blair a great man of history? He's probably more impressive than any of our guys. I've answered this question before, but Blair by definition is not a great man of history because he has worked entirely within a regime. A great man of history is fundamentally somebody who destroys an old order and builds a new one, right? So he is not a great man of history, but he is more of a kind of Machiavellian type who has been able to use an existing system to build his own power. So he, you know, if you use Mike Maxwell's thing, he is a Tyrrhic figure, not an Odinic figure, you know, which is, we should go back to Carlyle. These are the definition of the great man, especially if the great man comes as a king, you know.
When would you say, when was the last time the West, the traditional West, had a great man of history?
1930s.
Maybe, yeah. Go back
to Mussolini, Hitler, Stalin, FDR, arguably, Franco. These are all great men by any traditional metrics. Napoleon was a great man. I'm trying to think. Mao was a great man. Obviously, he was not in the West, but he was a great man by any. For Britain, you have to go back to Cromwell. Cromwell was a great man of history. Now you may be thinking, but Cromwell was terrible, AA. But this is the thing, or Hitler was terrible. This is the thing about a great man, right? They are fundamentally disruptive. They destroy what was before. They build something new, even if it doesn't last, for good or for ill. Cromwell's order only lasted, 12 years or something, 13 years? This is the nature of the great man of history. So great doesn't mean like, they're absolutely excellent. They're brilliant. Great just means like fundamentally different from the system man, if that makes any sense.
Mm.
So there we go. Bam. Yeah, great does not mean good, exactly. Yes, and I mean, it, in many respects, Putin is a great man of history as well, I think. And within their own specific countries, Orban and Erdogan are well on track to being thought of as great men as well, I would say.
Say G as well. I'd say G was.
The Chinese president, President Xi. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say he's on track as well. Although he's a little bit different because he did come in under the communist system. He's bent the communist party to his will, to be fair, and he has sidelined opposition and so on. But he hasn't like fundamentally broken with what existed before yet.
So, possibly not, no. Yeah. So basically all the in the modern era, like our lifetime, all the great men of history have kind of come from nations that are, you know, not beholden to the Western or American order, basically.
I mean, someone like Saddam Hussein was a great man of history, believe it or not.
Really? You
know, right. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean like good in all ways, like I said. So, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini was a great man of history, you know, which does not mean to say he was good. All right. Whereas Khamenei, the current Ayatollah, is not a great man of history.
No.
Even though he's been the Ayatollah since 1989, much longer than the original Ayatollah was there, he is just clearly not a great man of history in that same way. Right? So it's pretty easy to pass once you know what you're looking for. All right. That'll do. Nomad, where can people find you, sir?
Yeah, I'm still in the same places. Follow me on X, subscribe to me on Substack for all my writing. Got a lot going on there as usual. And you'll just see me around. Not doing as many streams as I've got other things going on. And obviously the great realignment, if we could say, since the end of UO is also a part of that. But yeah, I'm still about. So follow me and say hi, I guess. Yeah.
While we're going through it, Jim Henson, not a great man of history. Gaddafi, yes, a great man of history. Elon Musk, not a great man of history. Bukele, not sure yet. So there we go. All right, ladies and gentlemen, promo code Mandy, 25% off all courses. I'll be back tomorrow for reviewing Adam Curtis and, of course, my video on MAGA falling off. Guy who said Churchill banned, and I'll see you tomorrow. Nomad, just to let you know, it kicks us out straight away now. So cheers.
Oh, okay, does it?
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.